Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the resumed hearing. First up, we have Amelia Lindsay, and she's the social impact assessor on behalf of the council. She also has a written statement, and Mr. Jessen indicated that if we'd read it, then she could go straight to questions. But I'm in the position where I didn't do any homework last night, so I do need to hear it orally. So if we just proceed, and that's actually true of all the statements we received. I haven't read them, so I'll just take them as they come. So welcome, Ms. Lindsay.
Kia ora, thank you. I'm out in Pukekohe, so I do have a little bit of a Wi-Fi issue. So I will try and rattle through this relatively quickly. I've convinced all my children no classes till 9:30, so please bear with me. If it does get annoying, if sometimes I can see you before I can realise I can't hear you or you can't hear me, so just wave out if that's a problem. I'll try and...
That's fine. You're appealing to all the mums on the panel.
Yeah. No, I do apologise. It's been a frustrating few weeks. So I'm the author of the Section 42A report for social impacts, and in my summary statement I've provided comment on the following: the identification of potential social effects on the environment of allowing the freight hub, matters arising since the Section 42A report has been was prepared, including submissions of expert evidence, joint witness statements which have been involved with, and expert conferencing, and some matters raised from submissions at the hearing. And then I'll just conclude on some issues in relation to the social impacts that remain in contention.
I will come and get you.
It's nice for it not to be me. Firstly, it is my...
Alex Beer could mute. Thank you.
Is that coming from somewhere else?
I think it was Alex Beer, but I think they've been muted. Is that right? Anyway, I'll push on and we'll see if that's working. So firstly, it is my opinion that the methodology and approach for the social impact assessment prepared by Ms. Kirsty Austin is appropriate. I also agree with Ms. Austin's identification and the main potential positive social impacts that she's identified of the project. I further agree with Ms. Austin on the... Sorry, I'm just getting a little bit of feedback. I might flick my earphone off one ear. Further, I agree with Ms. Austin on the key potential negative impacts of the proposal, and that I consider there are likely to be impacts to way of life and amenity during construction, and on amenity, community connectivity and community character during operation. However, it is my opinion that the SAA has, and I've broadened this from my original evidence just to highlight the difference between the lack of the cultural impact. So I summarised this as three limitations. I know in my initial statement I referred to two, which results in the assessment not fully considering the scale of potential impacts, and in some cases I consider underplays the significance of potential impacts that may be experienced by some in the community. The limitations that I've identified are in those categories: the level of design input and information on which the SIA is based does not provide sufficient detail to assess potential adverse effects over time, particularly given uncertainty of timing and the potential stages of development. I consider that the proposed conditions for the designation provide for a range of different construction sequencing and development scenarios, and I do not consider that these potential options have been sufficiently or fully considered in the SAA, and therefore there is a degree of what I have termed potential optimism in the assessment of social impacts. There are a couple of examples I give in my earlier statement, and the one I highlight here is some of the reliance on vegetation and screening to be established in advance of construction works in areas like Sangsters Road. I also consider that there is a gap in the information provided by KiwiRail with the cultural values assessment, and I consider this may raise potential adverse social impacts that cannot be identified now on the basis of the information. To me, this risk should be acknowledged, and while I recognise that Ms Austin has indicated some conservatism in the significance assessment that she has given of potential impacts to address this, I feel that that is predicated on the scope of effects she has already identified, and this approach risks overlooking some specific impacts for that community or for that subgroup in the community. I also feel that the generalisation of assessment of potential adverse social impacts across the defined local area potentially obscures or averages out some impacts that may be higher for those in the community in close proximity to the freight hub. This includes those in the Bunnythorpe community area, particularly the Sanctus Road and Maple Street areas. I consider that this can be addressed through mitigation measures and proposed conditions, and I'll turn on that later. In light of the limitations, I consider that the scale of potential adverse effects could be of a higher adverse nature than those assessed by Ms Austin. I conclude on the basis of the information to date that these could be a level of moderate adverse, with the risk of potentially even higher considering those information gaps. And I identify that that's a potential over both the construction and operation of the effects of the projects, particularly if they're a staged operation development. From a social perspective, I consider this risk is greatest for those who are living closest to the proposed site and who are part of the Bunnythorpe community, but also acknowledge information gaps again in their cultural impact assessment. I think Ms Austin has acknowledged this uncertainty in the evidence and makes some recommendations for additional mitigation measures, and I consider some of those were addressed in the conditions that were put forward. And when I say current condition, that this time I was talking about the conditions that have been put forward by Ms Bell and from KiwiRail and their evidence, and some which I do not have been considered sufficiently reflected in those conditions proposed by KiwiRail to date. And again, I can turn on some of those conditions and the conditions that were put forward by the council at the end. I consider, however, that there are potential for the conditions to go further, and that can provide greater confidence that the potential adverse effects can be appropriately mitigated. Section 2 just turns to the issues that I feel remain in contention. I consider it is appropriate and feasible to address the uncertainty of potential social impacts arising from the rail hub, the freight hub, through a comprehensive suite of conditions. And in particular, I consider that KiwiRail should be required to provide an opportunity for the community to engage with them about their concerns and provide opportunities to address these concerns in a process that would facilitate design outcomes for those areas of the site that interface with the community. I've recommended a number of the existing conditions are strengthened, and I've discussed those matters with Ms Copplestone. I've also recently participated in conferencing with the landscape, social and planning experts of both Council and KiwiRail. It was a productive discussion, and we agreed on a number of matters, but we did not agree on whether there should be a design framework, as the reporting officer has recommended. I remain of the view that the creation of an overarching design framework would help to address some of the uncertainty around potential future impacts, particularly given the long lead-in time anticipated before the freight hub becomes operational. A design framework would provide the opportunity for an integrated, iterative approach to addressing potential impacts identified by other specialists as well as social impacts. And I note in her evidence that Ms Austin acknowledges that there is likely to be value in that approach, but that these mechanisms are not currently provided for in the designation conditions. To try and assist, I've prepared an appended diagram to the statement that just demonstrates how I see the role of the design framework and a methodology for engaging and collaborating with the community might work to inform that process. As shown in the process diagram, I consider that the community liaison forum, mana whenua and stakeholders should have an opportunity to identify key values and principles to shape the design framework, and that they are given an opportunity to review that draft design framework and provide feedback to it before it is finalised. In my opinion, this will assist to address potential adverse effects on sense of place and the value the community have in their local environment. I also recommend a condition specifying that management and outline plans must demonstrate compliance with the outcomes and principles of the design framework. And this provides a mechanism for that ongoing development of the design, referring back to the principles that have been agreed. In particular, this is aimed at the interface with the community and responds positively to the outcomes that they have identified as being important. The creation of a design framework was discussed in the expert conferencing in August, and I'll turn to that in section 4, I think, of the statement. I just want to turn to a few matters that I've heard raised in the hearing, both in Ms. Austin's presentation and in some of the submissions. I've also listened to the evidence of Ms. Rimmer on landscape and visual matters and comment on that where it is relevant below. Firstly, I agree with the Commissioner's comment that in terms of accessibility to information, it is appropriate that information about the project and opportunities to provide feedback to that be shared with the community through a range of media. I consider that the engagement plan is an appropriate place for these mediums to be outlined, and I understand the conditions have been amended to reflect some of that, and there are some further recommendations from Ms. Copplestone, which I agree with. I agree with both Ms. Austin and the Commissioner that the role of the group facilitator is important to the success of a community liaison forum, and that this person should be selected on the basis of their skills and expertise. In my experience, the facilitator should act as a bridge between the requiring authority and the community, not as an advocate for either group. However, I also consider it is really valuable or critical even that the recommendations made by the CLF are fed back to the requiring authority to be actioned by the project and construction teams. And for this reason, I consider that a facilitator appointed from KiwiRail rather than necessarily independent may be appropriate. It's just a clarification on a matter I heard at the hearing. The Commissioners have also raised questions about the efficacy of the existing proposed conditions, including noise and dust, in allowing for information and engagement sharing with the community. I agree with Ms. Austin that timing is key to the efficacy of these conditions, in particular providing the community with information in sufficient time for them to consider the information and respond to the proposed management approaches if needed. Just turning to the design framework, there is a challenge here in balancing the community interest in receiving certainty in terms of what they can expect at each stage of the project and flexibility needed for the requiring authority, particularly given the long lead-in time of the project and the fact that the identification of stages will likely be driven by technical and operational decisions rather than just the community aspirational input. A key facet of the proposed design framework is that it will be prepared before the creation of management or outline plans and not alongside them. And I consider that's important, that order is important in allowing the community sufficient time to understand the design process, understand how the project development will occur and feed into emerging design opportunities. I consider the design framework will enable the community to have a degree of comfort that while aspects of the project will change as the design and construction progresses, the overarching outcomes and the way that each stage will interact with the community can be responded to. This, in my opinion, goes some way to addressing the flexibility versus certainty challenge that's been identified in, earlier in the hearings discussion. I recall Ms. Rimmer's reservations about the design framework and in particular noting that she considers that the landscape and design framework or landscape and design management plan could cover most of the objectives mentioned in the proposed design framework conditions. And I do acknowledge that that would be possible to move key points of that design framework into the landscape design plan. I consider, however, that it's important that the design framework is a separate document which will sit above and provide guidance to a number of other management plans. In particular, I consider it as appropriate as it acknowledges not a document prepared by and for the landscape planning in the project. As all other management and outline plans need to give effect to the objectives of the design framework, I consider it appropriate for it to sit as an overarching document rather than integrated into another plan. Ms. Rimmer also pointed out that under the current condition wording, as proposed by KiwiRail, the creation of the CLF design framework and Mana Whenua engagement plan would all occur simultaneously. And I agree that that creates difficulties in terms of ensuring community and Mana Whenua input into design. And for this reason, I suggest that the design framework condition is amended to allow more time for its creation and to be explicit that its developers do inform those subsequent plans. I consider that issues of timing around the development of the plans can be resolved with careful attention to the conditions and diligence by the requiring authority in implementing those processes.
All right, Amelia.
Sorry.
Ms. Allison, I don't know if others are picking it up, but there's really bad feedback.
Where is that feedback?
Yeah, I don't think it's... I wonder if the venue...
That is the lawyer for KiwiRail.
Okay.
Yes, I'm getting quite bad feedback from her as well.
Yeah, and I just wonder if the venues have been muted. Good morning, sir.
Hi.
Hi. We're just hearing really bad feedback, and I just wonder if the venue in Metro could mute. I did it while Amelia was with me.
You're sounding like someone on the planet Mars. I can't hear you adequately to understand what you're saying. Try again.
Thank you, sir. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Great. For those of us on Zoom, Amelia's, there's really bad feedback coming through today.
Okay.
And I think it's bouncing around from the venue's event room, and so I just wonder if your tech guy could mute you guys. We might be able to hear Amelia better. Thank you.
If I try it down, is that working better? Yep, Gina's got a thumbs up. So. Sorry, Ms. Sweetman. Where was I up to? My apologies, I've got myself distracted. The final question from Ms. Rimmer was about who would create the design framework and how it would be prepared and certified. And again, I've tried to highlight that in the flow diagram, but in short, I think KiwiRail should be responsible for preparing that framework, and it would require and seek input from both the CLF and from Mana Whenua involved in the project in its early stages of drafting and review. Just turning to the cultural impact assessment, I agree with Ms. Austin that a cultural impact assessment should, where practicable, be led by Mana Whenua. In my experience, this may mean that a number of CIAs are prepared by different iwi or hapu groups. The fact that a CIA has not been prepared has therefore created a challenging situation whereby it is still appropriate and necessary for iwi and hapu values and knowledge to be considered through the NOR, but we're speculating perhaps on some of the nature of the issues to be considered through an SIA. And I don't feel that that's an appropriate approach either, and I think Ms. Austin has appropriately managed that complexity. Some insights that may have been captured in a CIA, such as whakapapa and land connections or historic place values and issues for the Māori community in the area, would, in my opinion, have likely informed or at least had a potential to inform the SIA. And I acknowledge that some specific issues about Māori traditions and relationships to the environment would fall outside the domain of an SIA altogether as well. Further to this, an SIA does have a responsibility to identify and consider specific subgroups in the community and the vulnerability of these groups to particular impacts. In my Section 42A report, for example, I identified the residents in the Bunnythorpe area as a specific subgroup. I consider there is potential that some social impacts may be specific or more significant for the Māori community, and there may be a number of demographic characteristics that, as a New Zealand trend, unfortunately, impact Māori more than others in the community. For example, lower rates of ownership or less participation in employment. I note Ms. Austin's comments earlier in the hearing that she has not observed a statistical difference between the Māori community and the wider local community. And I appreciate I haven't investigated this in depth myself, but I have done a bit of an initial search and suggest that there may be some differences between the groups, for example, regarding employment rates and household makeup, that might be something that would be explored through a cultural impact assessment. In addition, I note that my experience statistics in an area do not always equate to the actual experience of the community. A cultural impact assessment can add real value here by providing additional matters, for example, commentary on impacts of colonialisation or land loss grievances or specific place values, which may not be visible in statistics but could have a significant impact on the lived experience of the communities in the area. So in the absence of a CIA being prepared and with these issues I have listed in mind, I consider that the proposed Mana Whenua engagement framework is an essential part of the proposed conditions, and the link between that and the design framework is really important as it will provide any such issues to be identified and responded to. Turning to submitter evidence, I have listened to the evidence presented by Carolyn Glenn Woodfield regarding their sound sensory issues and associated concern about the impacts on the rail hub on their way of life. They noted in their presentation that being able to have input into KiwiRail's plans in regard to management of community concerns, or at least being kept updated to those plans for development, would be useful in allowing them to understand what is proposed and put their own plans in place to deal with the heightened sensory environment. With this in mind, I consider that the Woodfield submission is an example of how the design framework and the community liaison forum would or could benefit the community by providing a degree of clarity on what can be expected through each stage of development. In section four, just turning to the expert conferencing. In August 2021, I participated in expert conferencing that focused on the proposed design framework. KiwiRail and the Council's experts agreed on a number of matters for management of potential impacts during the conferencing. For example, that design principles needed to be set early in the process and that Council should certify the process rather than the content of the framework itself. However, there's several matters that remained unresolved. Just highlighting those and my position on them. I agree it would be possible for the design framework matters to be covered in the landscape design plan, but I remain of the opinion that outlining key design principles in a separate document is the most effective way ensuring that design principles are given effect to in the construction and operation of the freight hub. I don't agree with KiwiRail's stance that the horizontal integration of the landscape design plan would generate better outcomes. I consider that horizontal integration of the documents would clearly communicate I consider that vertical integration of the documents would clearly indicate the overarching nature of these principles and the fact that they're expected to be integrated throughout all of the management plans to which they're relevant. Additionally, it would be difficult to effectively provide for the design principles and management plans if they are being developed at the same time as the landscape design plan. If a separate design framework is not provided, I consider it likely that development of this part of the LDP will also need to be led or have significant input from at least the social impact expert and cultural impact specialists and potentially the engagement specialists in addition to the landscape input. In other words, in my view, there's a need for that part of the plan if it were to be integrated with the landscape design plan to explicitly acknowledge the role of other experts in the preparation of that plan, which isn't the way that condition is drafted to date, in my opinion. In conclusion, I consider that the absence of a more detailed impact assessment supporting more detailed information on the construction, operation and timing of the proposal, the appropriate approach is to include a comprehensive suite of conditions in the designation to provide KiwiRail an opportunity to engage with and respond to community concerns during implementation. I consider that the additional mitigation conditions I have recommended, and particularly that creation of a design framework, are the most appropriate means of responding to that uncertainty and the uncertain social impacts of the proposal that remain. Thank you.
Turn my microphone on now, and Commissioner Sweetman, have you got any questions?
Marina, Ms. Lindsay, thank you for that and taking us through it. I've got a few questions for you. For starters, can you take us through the conditions as recommended now by the council, if you have those with you? And just talk us through the changes that you've been recommending.
Certainly, yes, I can do that. I am working. I don't have a printer either, and I'm not intending to moan, but I'm just moving documents in front of me, so it's a little bit of a juggle. So bear with me. Certainly. So just working through, and maybe although it's slightly out of order, I will. Start with the most substantive change, which is the recommendation at condition 32A through for the design framework. So the intention of those conditions is that that framework would be prepared before undertaking the detailed design of the rail hub and before preparation of management plans, and those management plans refer back to condition 9. So it's through that mechanism and then a little bit subsequent, we talk about the fact that this is to inform a number of management plans rather than just the landscape plan. the intention is that it will set out the design principles and outcomes for the design. I liken this in a lay term. This is about, identifying the what it is we're expecting the project to deliver at the interface with the community, so that the community can set, can be informed, and from an engagement perspective, can be involved in that process, where the management plans are going to be expert-led, and from an engagement perspective, the community will be more informed in responding to them. So just on that spectrum of participation, I think this is a higher participatory stage than the management plans that will be followed and driven by some of the operational requirements of KiwiRail. And I think Ms. Austin ran through the importance of being crisp about the opportunities that the community have to be involved and how they will be involved in those processes. The next stage of those conditions is identifying the relationship between the preparation of the framework and the community liaison framework, liaison forum, and how that will be the mechanism for the community alongside mana whenua to participate in the design framework. So it's looking to establish some of the mechanisms for input into that design framework from the community and from mana whenua. We've then run through in conditions about how it will be prepared and the certification process. The conditions then run through the principles of what it should look to achieve, largely at 32G. Some of those have had my input, and some of those have been developed with the landscape expert, with Ms. Whitby as well. So I would refer to those. But again, looking to how the community will interact with the designation, and particularly the connections between the designation and some of the outcomes that are identified there and the surrounding community, both in respect of landscape and visual effects, but also in terms of connectivity and the pedestrian cycle access, for example. That is not intended to be an exhaustive list, and I think that's important because we don't have the cultural impact assessment at this stage, so it's intended to be an inclusive list that's been identified in the conditions. The condition 32H was just seeking to identify the fact that conditions can have quite a long life. Things may happen that mean that there is some time between the preparation of the framework and the commencement of construction, or in particular operation. So there's just a process in there for it to enable a review if there is some time delays in that process. Just acknowledging plans for requiring authorities can change over time. So just to give a bit of security that if there has been a lag time, that the dynamics of the community will be able to be reflected in the design framework and the outcomes identified in it. So that's the intention of the conditions that have been put forward, or my intention of the conditions that have been put forward in the design framework. Ms. Copplestone would be able to talk more detail about the operational requirements. There are a few other matters that I set out and made recommendations in the conditions that have been reflected in some of the changes that Ms. Copplestone is recommending, and I'm happy to run through those as well. In particular, in the community liaison forum, and I appreciate KiwiRail has made changes in regard to the timing and the duration of that in conditions 11 and 12. Then moving to condition 13, feel it was important just to emphasise the role of and the need for communication about the staging of mitigation works and temporary mitigation works that may be proposed, and that's reflected in condition 13. And then working through condition 17 is probably the next one where some changes have been included and incorporated, and that's just to more explicitly identify the role of the community liaison forum in inputting to the design framework and to the subsequent management plans, and again trying to reflect some of the stages of engagement and consultation that would be undertaken there. And then more overtly in condition 25, see how the effects of the construction activities could be mitigated through some of those subsequent plans. Again, trying to show the link of how those management plans are responding to some of the feedback and information that they've received from the community liaison person going into the construction process. Ms. Copplestone will be able to comment more on Condition 30A, but I'm certainly supportive of and see the need for that mana whenua engagement process to be woven into both that design framework and the subsequent conditions. So there, beyond that, I think most of the other changes are ones that have been identified and confirmed with KiwiRail. So that's sort of my quick helicopter view, maybe, of how I've tried to inform the conditions and how I've been working with Ms. Copplestone about what those conditions are seeking to achieve.
Thank you, Ms. Lindsay. That's been really helpful. One thing that's been vexing me a bit, and I'll just refer to your process diagram, which I found very helpful at the back of your evidence, was the timing and the appropriate timing then of the mana whenua engagement framework into the system, and how that should then reflect and inform or not management plans and outline plans as well. So I'm quite keen for your view on that, particularly since you've just this morning talked to us about the absence of the project.
Yes, I think in my opinion, this is an appropriate way to acknowledge that there is at least a degree of uncertainty about the scale and significance of those potential impacts. And while I, again, having looked at the evidence and read the information and submissions from KiwiRail, I understand that there has been consultation and ongoing input from mana whenua. I don't think we've rested at or we've reached a conclusion where we can assure ourselves of what the cultural impact values are and how they've been responded to in the conditions. And for that reason, I feel that it's important that that process is given sufficient time to input into setting up what the outcomes of the design framework can be. And then that would then inform, in my view, the management plans and some of the detailed design work that would follow. So in my approach, what I'm seeking to do is to make sure that that step comes in before that design framework is developed, and that design framework then informs the subsequent management plans. And I think that's an important element to address that potential uncertainty.
So on that note, do you think the conditions the council has recommended to allow that staged approach to occur? Or is that a question I should put to Ms. Copplestone instead?
I think it is. In my review of them, I'm satisfied that it has got that sequence established in it, but certainly Ms. Copplestone has a much more intimate knowledge of the structure of those conditions, so I think that would be appropriate.
And a final question from me. Have you, in your experience, dealt with proposals such as this, where it's ultimately seeking to defer assessment of cultural effects and until the outline and management plan or subsequent management plan approach? And then obviously your view on the appropriateness of that as well.
Yeah, look, in my experience, there is often complexity and a lot of engagement and relationship building required with mana whenua from agencies, particularly Crown agencies like we're talking here, that can mean that cultural impact assessments themselves can take a long time to be formed, and I've been involved in projects where, because of the complexity and nature of the number of iwi or hapu that have been associated with the project, there's been late identification of some of those groups and therefore cultural impact assessments coming from specific mana whenua or hapu that supplement other cultural impact assessments from other iwi. Certainly my opinion is it is more difficult to do it in retrospect. I suppose we are left with making a decision that there is still sufficient these mechanisms will provide a sufficient room within the designation to enable a design response or a management response to address the concerns. But I've certainly been involved in projects where cultural impact assessments have come as a process or program is progressing, and we've worked through them. So that does give me some confidence that it is feasible to address these effects in this way, those potential effects in this way. It wouldn't be a practice I would advocate at all, but I think it has been able to be successfully implemented in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Lindsay. That's been really helpful.
Commissioner Mackinson.
Good morning, Ms. Lindsay. I just have one quick question, and it's just following on from the conversation you were having with Commissioner Sweetman and around the deferral of the full assessment of cultural effects and cultural values. And you just said that it's not preferred, but it can be done successfully later. How important is it to have the right conditions in place to make sure that that happens? And are you comfortable that the conditions that have been put forward by Ms. Copplestone create that framework?
I'm not sure that I'm comfortable. I know we are trying to deal with an information gap, I think, and Ms. Austin has also made this comment, and I would strongly advocate that the cultural values and potential values and identification of those should be led by mana whenua themselves. I don't think we've... So my concern is that that does pose a risk. While I feel that the process and the timing that we've been working through and that Ms. Copplestone has identified allows for those matters to be considered, putting that into the design framework and then that informing the management plans is the best mechanism I feel that we can structure to enable those issues to be addressed subsequent to the designation being confirmed. I think that the difficulty in this decision is, are there potential impacts or severity of impacts that cannot be addressed within the footprint of the designation? And my concern is that we haven't got the cultural values information to satisfy ourselves that risk doesn't still exist, or I don't, rather. I should be clear. That may have been something that has come through or will come through in the hearings process, but at the moment we're just sort of relying on, not just, sorry, we're putting a structure around this, but it just relies on being able to address those issues within the designation footprint, and there won't be an ability subject to discussions with KiwiRail, which they may as a Crown agency take to respond to, but it doesn't put a requirement for anything to be done outside the designation, which may have appropriately addressed some of the effects and issues that are identified. So I think that with that caveat, I think this is the best feasible response we've worked to come up with how we might address that uncertainty.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Commissioner Pomeroy.
Morena, Ms. Lindsay. Yamahi o te ata ki a koe. Thanks very much for your Section 42A report and for your summary statement this morning, which has been very helpful for all of us. I think my fellow commissioners may have stolen most of my thunder, but I still have a couple of questions for you. You refer in your summary statement to the expert conferencing, and obviously you were unable to reach agreement with Ms. Rimmer around the design framework. You've said that Ms. Rimmer remains of the view that most of the objectives proposed for the design framework can be addressed within the landscape design plan. But you obviously have a different view about that. And you obviously, based on your statement, still feel that a design framework would help to address potential future adverse impacts. So I'm really interested in understanding the specific distinctions between the two frameworks. And perhaps if you are able to summarise what you consider to be the key advantages of the design framework relative to the landscape design plan, I think it is, that would be really helpful.
Kia ora, yes. To me, the key differences are the process of who's preparing a design framework. So I would look for a design framework to be a multi expert developed document where the landscape design plan will be led by the landscape architect. And I am in no way saying that that person wouldn't be qualified, but it's not a foregone conclusion that they would be qualified to consider some of the social and particularly the cultural values. So I think as a document that lifts and sits over the top of some of those other documents, it provides it a status that is informing many other experts and is prepared by many other experts. And I think that's important. I think the second major difference is, in my view, it is a in consultation processes in the International Association for Public Participation, and I think Ms. Austin ran through some of this as well, we have quite a distinction between empowering at one end where you would give it to the community to design, where you can collaborate and engage with the community about working collectively on design solutions, right through to informing, so you can tell the community what it is you're doing. And it is really important to be crisp and clear about which stage you are working at. And in my mind, management plans are going to be more about an inform and consult process, which is saying operationally KiwiRail will need to do this, or in my expert opinion, if I was a landscape ecologist, you know, these plants will be required in this area for these ecological reasons. And we're relying on a lot of technical and operational expertise. We're telling the community about it. They're providing comment. In the middle, which is where I think the design framework sits, we're acknowledging and engaging with the community about the values and how KiwiRail can respond to those collectively. So it's a more iterative and collaborative engagement process. And I think it is worth having it as a separate, explicit process to acknowledge the difference in the role that the community and mana whenua would need to have in establishing what was being achieved by that plan. In my view, a management plan will be more of a procedural document. We need to build this. We're going to do that. Do you have any comments? Reflect on those and respond to them. So to me, those are the two critical differences. Mm-hmm. And then some of the things like timing and review processes fall under that and try to give that give that meaning.
That's really helpful. Thank you so much for that. So just following on from that, your response there, how critical do you consider the design framework to be as part of the broader suite of mitigation measures that you've referred to in addressing the anticipated adverse effects and uncertainty of the NOR.
Sorry, there's me missing my mute button. I do think it's really important. I think it is, in my opinion, because a designation is providing an envelope for future development of which we don't have a lot of detail, this is the mechanism and opportunity for that check back to go, how is each stage or what as we go through that flexibility, how are we responding to it? So I think it's important for that reason. And I think it is increasingly, I think even of greater importance, perhaps of higher importance, is the fact that we do have this gap with the cultural impact and values assessment. And this is a mechanism by which to loop back and address that issue. And my concern would be if this process wasn't in there, and I hear that there is intent, and I'm not questioning that intent, but from my perspective as looking at the conditions from council, there isn't a requirement without this condition to close that gap.
Thank you. Just reflecting back on the submissions we've heard during this process, a theme, particularly from iwi submitters, was around the cultural and environmental design framework that was developed as part of the Te Ahua Tūranga project. And they were really keen on that template being adopted here. How familiar are you with that framework?
I was involved in the development of that framework from a social perspective, but the cultural aspects were led by the iwi themselves. So I'm familiar with it. I just wasn't involved in the cultural impact and values process that informed some of that.
Okay. Are you in a position to comment, though, on the sort of broader overall success or otherwise of that framework?
Yes,
and particularly in terms of mana whenua engagement and addressing cultural effects.
I think it provided an opportunity to do two things, and I say this as I say with that acknowledgement of perhaps more of an observer of that, but it has certainly established a much greater partnership approach between mana whenua and the requiring authority in the development of the design principles and design outcomes that will be delivered by the project. And I think that's important and acknowledges the Treaty of Waitangi in our processes. And so I think that's an entirely, that's been a very positive outcome. And I think that in that instance, the framework which we have drawn from, I suppose, in the recommendations for the design framework here, was done in advance of the designation, but developed as the hearings process went through. So a number of those design outcomes were already identified at the time of lodgement of the NOR. They were definitely advanced in the submissions and hearing process, that intent was already established. It is that intent we have drawn from, I suppose, and are proposing in these conditions as a first stage, basically, of implementing the notice of requirement. So that would be the key difference. But I think it has been a positive way of demonstrating some of the commitments to addressing impacts while allowing that subsequent design and management plan process to still kick in.
Thank you. That's really, really helpful. See if I've got any other questions. I think they may have already been asked. We've done that one. in that. You made a comment in your, I think it was your summary statement, yes it was, that if the landscape and design plan was the preferred option, and therefore, you know, the design principles, cultural, ecological principles were incorporated into that, as opposed to developing the broader design framework that you're proposing. You say that if that happens, it's likely that there will need to be a cultural impact expert specialist, potentially even an engagement specialist in addition to the landscape expert, all involved in developing the design principles, I guess, and outcomes, and inputting into this. And you said that would be a sort of an absolute minimum that you would expect should be provided through the conditions, should be provided for through the conditions, if that process was preferred. How practical is that option? You know, both in terms of logistically just bringing all those people together and enabling that work to happen, and also in terms of achieving the outcomes that are required in this sense.
Yeah, look, I think it is practical that it could happen, in that I've satisfied myself that I think the design framework process can happen. But I think what it's effectively doing, what it would effectively do, is separate the landscape and design plan into two parts. One part that was the larger inclusive outcome setting process, and the next would be how we were responding to that in the management plan. And I think from my perspective, it could be incorporated. You know, I think it is technically feasible. I think from a legibility point of view for the community of Mana Whenua, it's just simpler. And I'd even advise KiwiRail. I think that would be simpler to separate those two things out and be distinct about what the process is of development for the design framework, who's involved in it, and what the intended scope it has. Whereas if it was included in the landscape and design plan, it would essentially have that document doing two quite different things, a very high level overarching thing that would inform other management plans, and then its own management plan step. And I think that would logistically, I think that would be complex, and it would be difficult for the community in Mana Whenua to understand. Mm-hmm. And again, drawing from some of the comments Ms. Austin made, I think that actually makes it more difficult for the community to understand the differences in how they're going to engage with those different processes. Mm-hmm. I answer that with on the context of the design framework as we've presented and put it forward, being trying to weave that into the design, into a landscape and design plan. I'm not thinking of a third alternative in there, though. So that would be my, yep.
I understand. Thank you. That's a really helpful response. I think I just have one remaining question for you, perhaps two. Just to go back to the conditions, proposed conditions, and 32G, this deals with the design principles and outcomes for the design framework. Now, in relation to 32GF, it seems to me that the Mana Whenua engagement and values, well, the Mana Whenua values that will be identified through the engagement process, seems to be a different and perhaps separate issue to the one that's dealt with in F more broadly, about community identity and place, cultural historical values, which seem to me to be more in the context of social impacts. Would my take on that be right?
I think that that's very fair, and I think that reflects the experts that have been in the room making recommendations right. for these conditions. I do emphasise, and I know in my discussions with Ms. Copplestone, that was important that we put it not be limited to the following design principles and outcomes, because we're acknowledging that there is just that complexity of cultural values that none of the room had the expertise to answer or to provide guidance on. So the intention would be that would still be addressed through here, but it perhaps could be more overt that there are potentially G's, H's and I's following in those principles that haven't come through from the cultural
impact. That's helpful. Thank you. Sorry, I seem to be having a bit of a delay at my end. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, good. Yes. Sorry. Right. Thank you. That was really helpful. Just going back to 32G, one last question. Yes. I take the comment that you've just made actually in response to my question on F to probably also apply to the design outcomes, because I noticed there that there isn't any specific reference to cultural outcomes or mana whenua outcomes.
Yes, I think that would be the same. And I think in that instance, it probably could be extended just to, without needing to say what those outcomes were, it could just acknowledge yes. that those outcomes would need to be included. I think that's correct. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. Great. Look, thank you so much for your evidence this morning, Ms. Lindsay. It's been really helpful.
Thank you. Kia ora.
So I just have a couple of questions, if I can. In terms of the this process, the submitters, in a sense, are a self-selected cohort, and the responses of the host community overall have not been identified but assessed through a consultation process. To what extent is the fact that a number of local authorities have submitted in favour of the broad concept in some ways indicative of the broader assessment of social impact value of the project?
I think that is fair, and certainly I would acknowledge that there are positive social effects, and I identify and confirm that, you know, Ms. Austin has identified those, and I agree with them from the review. There are positive social effects associated with the project, or potential effects associated with the project. I have turned my mind mostly to the opportunities to manage and mitigate those adverse effects that I think are there as well alongside that. But I would acknowledge that there are positive social consequences of the project, and that they have been identified, as you say, largely through the expert assessments, but also through some of the consultation and submission engagement. Yes.
On this question of identity is a mobile experience. Historically, Bunnythorpe was identified as the potential spot for what was called Mugby Junction, which was to be the major rail area. And it's evident over time that it has been the host community of various projects, including substations and so forth. In that sense, looking at those historical aspects, is there a sense in which this proposal isn't actually completely completely incongruous with Bunnythorpe's identity.
I certainly think that opportunity is there for it not to be, and again, I think that is the opportunity that the design framework and the management plans have to respond to those design opportunities and to that integration opportunity. These are managing the potential for a disconnect or an adverse consequence that's not for, and there is then the opportunity, I suspect, in some instances, like with walkways and things, for positive outcomes to be identified and to reinforce some of that history and value to the community. I do agree with you. It is really important that the dynamic nature of societies and communities is also taken on board, and a lot of this is about managing the change to the community and the change that will happen as a result, both positively in terms of employment and economic activity, to the community as the project develops and as the rail hub becomes operational, but acknowledging that there are some adverse consequences that can be managed by addressing some of the interface issues with the existing community that are there. So, yes, in my opinion, this is about how you're managing that change rather than instances, and I have been involved in projects where the social change is incongruous completely to the character of a community, and in those instances you're not supportive of, or you can't find a mitigation path through to address the potential adverse effects of social change, and I don't think that's the case in this project. It is a large project and big change, but it is not incongruous, I suppose, in the long-term scope.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good framework. And in terms of that, I guess we have to recognise the human story is one of adaptation to change and the ability to use change to flourish. And so you're saying that those opportunities exist as part of the pathway.
In my opinion, particularly in social, and I feel more constrained about making that comment, insufficiently experienced or qualified to make that confirmation in respect of some of the cultural values, because we don't have them here. But in the social impact assessment domain, yes, I agree. This is about managing the transition and for the community and the opportunities that will create. And I certainly have seen in my experience on projects, on significant infrastructure projects and major change projects, positive opportunities and positive social outcomes that can arise from projects that communities see as an adverse change that is facing them at the beginning. These processes and community engagement and participation in the design and development of some of those interfaces can make them a positive social change outcome. A difficult one for communities to see because the extent and scale of change is so big, but I do think that opportunity is there in the process and in the conditions as they have been put forward by Ms. Copplestone.
Thank you. That's helpful. Now I just want to slightly push back on the design framework concept.
Sure.
And in asking those questions, I'm focusing on 32 capital G as a proxy for the potential value that the design framework might provide on the assumption that principles A to F are going to be your best effort with Ms. Copplestone and the other consultants to identify the value of the final design framework. So that's the thrust of where I'm coming from. Does that make sense?
It does. The only thing I from a social perspective, I agree to the extent that we've identified the principles that is the intent from our expertise, but it's also, in my view, the value of the design framework is working through that with the community and mana whenua to confirm those principles and potentially to add some. So it is that step before G, I suppose, of how the community and mana whenua are engaged in identifying and shaping some of those principles themselves.
Sorry, repeat that again.
Sorry. I was just saying that 32G at the moment identifies the design principles from our expert opinion as the best foot forward at the moment. Mm. But the first stage in developing the framework, which involves inclusion of mana whenua and the community, may identify further opportunities for some design principles and values to be identified. And I think that's an important step in how the design framework process is intended to work. That is not an exhaustive list. That's our first foot, and there may be some others that are coming from the community of mana whenua that would be brought into that process as well.
Right. Appreciating that, those principles reflect a proxy for the potential value of the design framework, and so let's explore those. Sure. And the premise that we start from is that now we have a set of conditions that, to some extent, provide the design concept as the basic design framework, and layered on that is quite a lot of information about landscape mitigation and all sorts of other information and methods contained in technical evidence that is incorporated by reference in condition one as the way in which the proposal will need to be implemented. So when you talk about information gaps, you have to be finding gaps in that totality of information between a management plan and that information, which contains a design guide that can add value. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that intermediate step has to add value, and to require people to engage in that as an additional round to this process, you would want to do it in a way which was authentic. And by that I mean you actually believe that it would actually count and matter in terms of real on-the-ground outputs. You wouldn't want to go through this process and the expense of it when it was essentially a charade. So bearing all that in mind, and this is a long question, I know. Subparagraph A says the relevant design principles from the Northeast Industrial Design Guide. Well, I can only speak for myself, but I've read the design guide and I'm underwhelmed by it as a mechanism for informing design, and I would suggest that the Isthmus witness for KiwiRail has done a far more detailed and thorough analysis of potential landscape mitigation and reference back to, in particular, regard to the Northeast Industrial Design Guide, as opposed to Condition 1, what I would regard as a retrograde step.
Now, Ms. Whitby may be able to provide some more commentary on the landscape elements of that. From a social perspective, in my mind, the opportunities, having looked at the Northeast Industrial Design Guide, some of the opportunities there might be about how the design integrates with as I say, I'm most interested with how the design guide and this framework helps to inform what is going on outside the designation and moving into the designation. And there are particular areas where KiwiRail identifies opportunities for that public interface, the walkways and cycleways, for example, around the stormwater features, as an example of that, and the opportunities that there may be for those detailed design processes to integrate with design plans that the community has for facilities or connections outside the designation footprint. So to me, it is those sort of examples which are the opportunity that the design framework provides. It is about the interaction between the community and the detailed design of this, acknowledging that some elements of this design may be 3 years, 5 years, 6 years into the future. So I would agree that if we had certainty that this development as set out in the ultimate design form was going to be built in one go and that would be what was on the ground, in that time frame, that would make me go, is a design framework going to assist, is that investment and that commitment with the community, how does that balance work? In this instance, with the uncertainty we have about how the staging of the design might work, how the duration and the change that will happen in the community over that time, in my mind, that is why in this case I am supportive of a design framework sitting in the designation process. In a similar way, I suppose, that the Northeast Industrial Design Guide sits in the process for that industrial zone for subsequent and long-term development of that area. So it's a process that's gone through acknowledging that time frame.
Well, I won't get into an argument about that, but that's not what the text says. So the text isn't about integration of community infrastructure, potential aspirations on the edges. It's very much directed at the site design side. So there is a disconnect between that text and what your expectation is. This is actually because the designation is a hybrid beast, it's a difficult beast if I've described it before. You actually, funnily enough, have more information than you do with zoning industrial, because it has both features of a project and post features of a zoning. So when the Northeast Industrial Zone was established, you had no idea what the structures were going to be and how they were arranged and how the landscaping was going to be done. And what you were effectively designing was management of the edge effects. Here we have a very thorough design concept that has been fleshed out by quite detailed, but not to design stage landscape treatments. I'm not sure the Northeast Industrial Design Guide is in any way useful or relevant to what we're dealing with here. But maybe that's a question I need to put to a planning witness.
Yeah, and Ms. Whitby has also been working through some of the landscape principles in terms of that design guide, and I may be able to provide some comment as well.
So then turning to subparagraph B, a whole of landscape approach to appropriately integrate the freight hub with its immediate and wider landscape setting. I'm not quite sure what a whole of landscape approach is and why the concept design with its landscape elements is not integrating with its immediate setting. In ways, so at the design framework stage, which is not the design framework, at the design management, what's the other management plan or the process that we have for design?
The landscape and design plan.
The landscape and design plan. is a refinement of that broader concept to get the detail. I'm somewhat on Ms. Austin's side that given the level of detail, adding that layer with principles of that coarser nature is actually taking us back outside condition one rather than truly an intermediate valuable step. So do you think that Ms. Austin has a respectable opinion there that potentially this is a redundancy that might won't add value?
I think there are two, as I set out in my evidence, in my opinion, there are those risks inherent in the way that the assessment, so the social impact assessment has assumed, not assumed, sorry, that's not, has relied on the completed and full development of the rail, the freight hub in its assessment. And I think the staging and interim development potential here hasn't been reflected in some of that design. I think the lack of the cultural values assessment means that while we may have comprehensive design input on some of those values, we have not got it on all of those values, and I think that needs to be acknowledged. And I think that the opportunities to work through and identify exactly in answer to your first question of this is a significant change to the community, and the opportunities to work with the community and identify how positive outcomes can be delivered, particularly once a project is known to be going ahead, then it's a conversation about what are the opportunities that we as a community can work through to maximise benefits that we see for, and as I say, I go to some of those outcomes like the connectivity around the site to and from Bunnythorpe with the walkway connections and things. Those sort of opportunities, the community is in a better position to be able to have that conversation at the time a designation has been confirmed. But at the moment, they're in a position of, do we want the designation or not? And that they're faced with that conversation. This is a subsequent conversation about now those opportunities, now the project is going ahead, how do we work to maximise the positive opportunities out of the project design and the interface design?
Well, there's two points, I guess. One was a statement and one's a question. If KiwiRail has funded for the acquisition of land and has acquired 40% of the site, and if those funds would have to be refunded if the site didn't go ahead, I don't know what the arrangements are, but it seems to me that the idea that KiwiRail is not committed to the site would be an inference that isn't justified on the evidence. But in terms of your second point about the timing, which is an underlying theme of the integration verb, why isn't it better just to say in a condition the landscape and noise mitigation treatment will be integrated at reasonably practicable as soon as reasonably practicable as part at the timing of the development of particular parts, so that you're actually using a tool to address the point about the solutions or the mitigation occurring in a way which is temporarily appropriate, then adding this more general concept of a design framework. I mean, if your aim is to say, look, this is the design, it does need to be refined through the landscape and design management plan, but our major concern is to have them implemented reasonably promptly at the time of construction. Why don't we just say that?
In my view, the conditions do say that, and that's appropriate, and I agree with it. But I think the design framework provides an opportunity to explore what some of those opportunities that haven't been thought about to date might, as we move through, I suppose, how the community is going to develop and respond to this, to the freight hub, it provides an opportunity for some of that, for that to be explored with the community rather than developed up by KiwiRail and responded to by the community. So it's just a more, a greater level of community involvement and participation in it.
Right.
And as well, I say, mana whenua.
Yeah. Being a lawyer, I get obsessed with text. And when you impose a condition, I expect that anyone who's looking at this condition reads the text and says, this is what I have to achieve or do. And the words particular regard, or must include these principles is intended to constrain design. So C, design noise mitigation measures to have particular regard to visual amenity, outlook and privacy and landscape character. What do you mean? Is that, to what extent is that adding anything to the problems that the design management plan is aimed to address? Recalling that is part of the particular detail that detail of design, where you have to look at those things as part of your noise mitigation strategy.
Yeah. So, again, in my experience, a noise management plan is prepared by a noise expert, and a landscape management plan is prepared by the landscape expert, and the two plans are often prepared concurrently for a stage or phase of a development, and the intention is that the design framework would provide some overarching principles of how some of that integration would be responded to over the top of, rather than alongside and working through those conflicts. As I said, I think there are ways that it could be done within the plans, but I think for the reasons I set out, that this provides an overarching guidance and tool to give some direction on how to integrate those potential conflicts or potential tensions between different management plans.
Yes, except I guess I'm just testing the idea, and part of this is questioning that might be unfair, yeah, because it's to a planner. But if we are, impressed by the isthmus evidence by KiwiRail in terms of the general design concept, and condition one requires the development to occur generally in accordance with the information provided, then the introduction of these principles could be an erosive force on condition one, in the sense of suggesting that there is a re-litigation or a reconsideration of those designs, actually leading to less confidence about the outputs that we're seeking to achieve, which is against, I think, one of the laudable themes of the Section 42A reports, which is to introduce a degree of more certainty about the outputs.
Look, Ms. Copplestone will have a more
cogent answer, I think, from a planning perspective that I'm going to give. But the answer I would give is that from a social perspective, I do see that there are still some information gaps in the, and clearly the most notable of those, so the easiest one to point at is the cultural values assessment. I think that that does create a situation where there is that risk of inherent uncertainty, because we do need to respond to those matters, and we are looking to find a way that and some of the social interface issues can be responded to without corroding, as you say, the sort of principles of that landscape design. But I think in my experience, it is correct. A design framework would usually inform some of the things that we have in condition one proposed now. So it would have been established before some of these, rather than as part of a designation, as part of the designation requirement as a subsequent phase. But in my view, it's an appropriate step because of some of that information gap that we still have. But I'll leave to Ms. Copplestone to sort of answer the more sort of how that relates to the technical issues of condition one and how those are working in her view.
Right. Just turning to subparagraph E, design of buildings and structures to reflect where practicable the rural character and context of the receiving environment. I'm not sure how you could do that with this project. I mean, it is a very utilitarian structure, set of facilities that are intended to be mitigated by perimeter treatments to some extent. But it is going to be, arguably less impactful than the Northeast Industrial Zone because of its concentration of buildings, but it's certainly going to be a rail yard with functional buildings and log yards and container terminals. And if we recognise it as fundamentally an inland port, the idea that you would design buildings and structures to reflect where practicable the rural character and context seems to me saying something that's simply unachievable.
I think in part Ms. Whitby again may have a comment on some of the integration with the landscape element and some of the direction from her for that answer. I think in my consideration in that is that while I acknowledge the Northeast Industrial Zone and the extent of that area, this designation crosses and comes, in fact, impacts in a small degree on residential zone land. So at its northeast side is up against a quite different environment from that of the north of the industrial zone.
True.
And I suppose it's probably those edges where I would have concern for some of that opportunity as you're moving between that residential and village environment of Bunnythorpe into that, and how you're managing that transition between those two things, I think is, it, from my perspective, from a social perspective, would be where I would be focusing that concern in terms of what the form looks like there. And again, I appreciate there is funding and vegetation around that area, but it will be also what things look like from the walkway and cycleway around the stormwater features in that area.
Yes.
So it's those sort of opportunities. But again, Ms. Whitby may have some more insight or thought on some of that landscape approach than me.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That's been extremely helpful, and I appreciated your very articulate answers to these questions, and it's been most interesting. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
We were going to call Mr. Lloyd next, but Ms. Whitby, sorry, is also talking. There's a bit of overlap in the subject matter with Ms. Whitby, so it might be appropriate.
Okay, to well, call let's her do next. That. So, is Ms. Whitby in Auckland being ported in as well? Is she?
Ms. Whitby's right behind
us.
Oh,
okay. Sorry, there we are.
Commissioner Marson, can we just take a few minute break to have a stretch, please?
Yes, certainly. So we'll resume at 10:40, and by that stage, Ms. Whitby will be ensconced in her position.
Thank you.